everyone. So great to see you all on this fourth day of the Conference on World Affairs. I'm just going to interject here a little moment to say I'd love it if you would support the Conference on World Affairs. And you can do it in so many ways. You can go to the app and go into donate. You can go into the CWA website and punch the donate button. Or you can get, producers will have envelopes at the back, so when you leave, if you'd like to help CWA thrive, you can do it that way with regular envelope envelopes that you can send back to the foundation that we work with. So welcome. You have a treat in store for you. I'm so excited. Ron Boswick will be right out, and Liz Winstead. Yay.
Hi.
Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you that don't know, this is the Molly Ivins Memorial Plenary. Laughing matters. How to use humor to activate and educate. This is panel number 4800. It is Thursday, April 13th at 4 p.m. here in Mackey Auditorium. And as Betsy said, my name is Ron Bostwick, and I'm the moderator for this session. Just a couple of business items before we get going. If you would, please turn off your cell phones and any other noisemakers that you may have. I don't know what other noisemakers you could have besides cell phone. Is anybody coming in here with, you know, pop things? With probably not. Just a reminder that audio and video recording and still photography is not allowed here in Mackey. We have enough chairs, so probably nobody's going to be sitting in the aisles or blocking any doors today. Our guest and I are going to talk for a bit, and then we'll look to you guys for questions that you have for Liz. We encourage you to use the new Conference on World Affairs app on your smartphone. If you have it, you'll be able to submit questions that way. If you don't have your phone with you, or if you want to write down your question, you're welcome to do so. We do have note cards, and Margaret, our producer, is here. You can just raise your hand. She'll give you a note card to fill out and then take it back from you later to bring up to me. We will not be using microphones in the house, so if you do want to ask a question, the app or a note card is the way to do it. And do please remember that students and their questions get preference. So if you're a student filling out a card or submitting via the app, just note that you're a CU student and let us know that you are, if you would. Well, Molly Ivins was a longtime participant of the Conference on World Affairs, and she said it offered, quote, whole new ways of looking at old questions and information that can transform the way that you look at things. My hope is that after today, you'll have a new way to laugh and be moved to action, hopefully. Although the seeds of who Liz was to become were planted many years ago, back then she had no idea where it would take her to where she is today. Then in 1991, she was about to find her new comedy voice from a frustration that came from the not yet teenage cable television. When you say your prayers tonight, you can be thankful for Liz for three things that she's done to advance comedy and activism. One, she co-created The Daily Show. Two, she helped start Air America Radio. And three, she introduced Tom Arnold to Roseanne Barr. We still like her. So with the title, Laughing Matters, How to Use Humor to Activate and Educate, it's an honor for me to introduce the subject of this year's Molly Ivins Memorial Plenary, comedian, writer, producer, and troublemaker, Liz Winstead. Take this one. Hey, Liz.
Okay. Do you have a good side?
Is that your good side? Are you okay with over there?
I don't have a good side. I just have a mouth.
Close enough.
Sam.
This is your first conference.
It is.
You having a good time? People treating you well?
Yeah, it's been really good. I feel like there's a lot of really concerned white people, and I feel really good about that. Good on ya.
I want you to talk about how I mentioned here in your intro, how the Gulf War in 1991 sort of led
shit,
to...
We're opening with this?
No, I'm going to open with okay. that. Because it sort of is the start, from what I know about
yes.
you. You know, it's the start of how you really became more active in activism, adding a certain activism into your routine.
Sure.
Your comedy routine. And how that led to The Daily Show and led to you sitting here.
Okay, so...
Am I wrong?
No, it's great. It's just we're kicking off with like a whole dirty... I'm going to swear and talk about sex. Is that all right?
Yeah.
So just... Okay. Okay, so I was a person who, you know, was part of the feminist club in college, and when I started doing comedy, my comedy didn't really reflect my politics. You know, I would do activist-y things. I would talk about things that affected women, but I didn't talk about politics really. And so I moved to New York from Los Angeles in 1991. And I was home one night, and a friend of mine called me and said, "Hey, I met a guy that I really want to set you up with. I think this is good." And I was like, those things are never good. For those of you that don't remember, there was a thing called blind dates, where people who don't like you very much want to set you up with somebody that you wouldn't have fun having sex with. So I was like, okay, have him call me. I'm new to New York. This seems fine. So he calls me, and he's like, "So, you know, Nan thinks we'll have some things in common." And I'm like, okay. So I said, "So one of the things I really want to do is La Dolce Vita is playing at the Film Forum, which is a single screen, second run house in Manhattan." And he goes, "Oh, isn't that in black and white?" But I'm from Minnesota, so I said I was going to go on a date, so I'm going, because I keep my word when I say I'm gonna. So I meet the guy in front of the theater, and he shows up, and he's wearing a Yankees hat and a Yankees satin jacket.
Wow.
And I have a theory. My theory is, when a guy shows up wearing more than two pieces of sports clothing, they probably won't go down on you. So, already this date is just like, seriously. The story is going someplace, trust me. So, I have bad thoughts, I'm from Minnesota, I hate myself for having bad thoughts. We go into the movie theater, I realize I do not want to be part of this evening for very long, so I get the biggest bucket of popcorn I can for my dinner. With all of that crazy Monsanto yellow joy that you put on top of it. And I'm eating the popcorn and watching the movie, and this guy keeps falling asleep and rubbing, like, he keeps doing this, and then his satin jacket is rubbing against me, and I'm, like, just, like, annoyed for every reason. I can't focus on the movie, and, like, there's him, and there's the jacket, and I was like, ugh. And so I involuntarily, or voluntarily for a minute, and then again was mad at myself, I took my greasy hand and I woke him up on his jacket. And then I instantly felt awful that I wrecked his jacket, so then I prolonged the date by like, "Why don't we go have a drink after? I'm so sorry." And I'm like, "Why do I keep..." So he goes, "I know a sports bar." Of course you do. So we go to the bar that he frequents to watch something out of one of his hats or shirt or something. But there wasn't sports on that night. It was the night of the first Gulf War. And it was the night that America watched a war unfold in our living rooms and in our bars. And it was the night that we sat at the bar and I watched the TV. And at that point, CNN was the only cable news network. And CNN had changed. And CNN had graphics and a theme song, and the people who were normally giving the news were gone, replaced with like sort of attractive young people on roofs with green lights, and it all felt like a spectacle. And as I took it all in, I wasn't trying to be smart or anything, I just thought to myself, are they reporting on a war or trying to sell me a war? And like a couple seconds later, my date goes, you know, this is really awesome. And I was like, this is what this means. This is the world we're in with 24-hour news. And it's like, I don't really believe in epiphanies or whatever, but I did have an epiphany that night that if I noticed this weird, profound thing that was happening and that was giving people information about basically creating a situation where we would buy into bombing people because we wanted to be imperialists, I just wanted to expose that any way I knew how. So I stopped writing jokes about, you know, male Great Danes should have to wear underwear in public. No, that was a joke I told. And then started like getting more news and getting more information and really feeling like I was going to switch up what it meant to tell those stories. And that really was the first incarnation where I knew that the media was as much of a culpable factor in all of the shit that was happening as the politicians that were involved in what was happening. And so I did one-woman shows, and about 3 or 4 years later, I was working on, Jon Stewart had a syndicated talk show that was just a pop culture talk show, and I was a producer on that, and when that show got canceled, he was swooped off, and my bosses got moved over to Comedy Central, and they said, we want to do a show that responds to the world. Do you want to do it? And I was like, I've never done a show, but sure. Why not? It's like my dream. And it was that day that I was actually allowed to create a television show with like very little experience and then be the head writer. And then they gave us a year to put the show on the air to get the bugs out. That's never heard of now. So we were able to just watch, learn, grow, and follow the course of the news and then satirize what that was. And so when oftentimes when people will say, are you surprised at the success of The Daily Show? And I will say, I'm more surprised at how horrible our actual media became. Because those two things had to go hand in hand. For The Daily Show to succeed, the mainstream cable media had to become just a shit show. And it did. And it was like, we were just the umbrellas. Like, boo. That's a long story. I'm sorry. No, you don't have to clap. Don't clap.
For people who might, you know, be looking to make that change, that leap into being more active, you know, you're somebody who grew up in Minnesota.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about that phrase, Minnesota nice.
Yeah, that's not a thing.
You know, we're all nice.
Yeah, we're all real nice until we're super passive aggressive. I can't tell you. I mean, here's one of my favorite Minnesota stories. So my parents were really conservative. My mom was like almost entirely Swedish. And do you guys remember, it's like a Minnesota thing. Do you remember about 5 years ago when they found a Nazi in Minnesota?
Yeah.
So they found a Nazi in Minnesota, like hiding out. So the Nazi lived on my aunt's block. And so my aunt calls my mom and she goes, that Nazi lived down the street from me. My mom was like, no. She's like, yeah, you know, and I gotta tell you, when his sister-in-law died, I brought over a hot dish and I never got the pan back. Then says, I should have known then. That is like classic Minnesota. Yeah, you know what, you don't return that hot dish pan. My mom had a lot of dead food in the freezer. Did you guys have this growing up? Like you would prepare for people to die? So there was literally single dish food in our freezer, just like stacked, and we weren't allowed to eat it. It was for when somebody died, you would have something prepared to bring to their house. And if in their grief they didn't think to return the pan back, well, then all hell broke loose. Crazy.
For those people that may want to make that leap into being more active, if they feel more nice.
Hot dish!
Well.
Yes.
How did, you know, what type of transition did you have to go through to become that person that was not just talking about activism, talking about politics in your routine, but putting it on a national television show, you know, which is a bigger stage.
Right. Well, I think what was really cool was when the network approached Madeline Smithberg is the other co-creator, and she had TV experience, and I just had like a lot of experience being politically active, and I worked for a brief time on a TV show. The one thing I said to them was, it's really important for me that the media has a character in this. And so that to me was really important. And they were like, yeah, okay. But there was a battle because they really wanted the show to be pop culture, sort of like an Entertainment Tonight satire. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense to me because you also tell me you want to have celebrities in the guest segment. And so if you're going to do a show that shits on celebrities, you're not going to get celebrities. Why not do a show that shits on people who are like profoundly doing damage to our democracy and then have celebrities on as the like palate cleanser? That makes more sense. I literally got union carbide jokes on the air, you guys. Like, I was really proud of myself. So in the course of it, it was butting heads a lot, and it was trying to find its way. But I think the frustration for me always was when you work in corporate media, the call to action piece they don't want that. It's not, and it's also not that role, right? They're there to entertain people, and if you can get a message in, you're kind of sneaking it in, even in a show that purports to be like kind of a messenger-ish kind of show. And so after a while, it became hard, and I often say that like I felt like an anger fluffer. Get people riled up, and then they'd be like, what are we doing? I'm like, I don't know, I've got to go do another show tomorrow, figure it out. And so that was really frustrating for me. So in the course of my journey to where I am now, you know, it was like, I love that this show exists. I love that there's information that is like giving people, elevating things. I think it's hilarious that The Daily Show, when we would call ourselves fake news, and now there's like actual fake news, and The Comedy Show has more facts. It's like, so I was trying to find the space where you could pull all those pieces together. So you could bring people in with the humor and the fun, give them a message within the fun, and then when they're like ready to go, you have a plan in place. And so after I left there, I did some other shows and off-Broadway stuff, and then I launched Air America Radio, and which I thought was going to be kind of a place where I might be able to do that, but it was still a for-profit radio station. And I'll never forget walking into the office of one of our funders, who was also my boss, because he was a funder. I mean, it was like kind of a crazy thing over there. And he said, we're trying to get John Kerry elected here. And I said, I'm trying to get to the truth here. And so hopefully that means John Kerry will get elected. But like, I expose hypocrisy for a living. That is like why I'm here. That's why I was hired. And if that doesn't make you happy, I shouldn't be here. And so, cut to a year and a half later, I was on the air, and I was interviewing, oh God, what's his name? He's the guy that wrote all those Left Behind books. What's his name? Yes, LaHaye. And his wife is part of that Concerned Women. They're not that fucking concerned, let me be honest. Yes. So he's a bazillionaire writing these books. So he's talking about the rapture, and he's talking about there's this strain of Christianity that believes that, like, you know, in you were just whatever you're given is who you're. If you were poor, you're just supposed to be poor, and that's just the way it works. And no amount of anything is going to take you out of that lot. That is your lot that God gave you. So Rachel Maddow was my co-host on this radio show. And she said, so if I'm gay, let's say I buy your thing and I'm no longer gay, what, do I then still go to hell? And he goes, yeah, you still go to hell because you're gay. He was destined for hell. And she goes, okay. Then when the rapture comes, can I have your stuff? And I walk out, we walk out of the radio and we're laughing, and I go into my office and the boss is there and he's like, we're letting you go. I said, because of that? And he said, no. we were having internal changes, and we have a new CEO, and this CEO doesn't believe that humor plays a role in change. So they got rid of me, they got rid of Mark Maron, they got rid of the whole comedy writing staff, they relegated Rachel Maddow to 5:30 in the morning, and they replaced our show with Jerry Springer. You know, there's some shit in your life where you go, for sure one thing that's never going to happen to me in my career is that Jerry Springer is going to take my job. Like, that was the like the most absurd thing that happened until Trump. Really. It's like, nuts.
Did you know that Air America, did you have this idea that Air America was going to be, you know, did you have long-term plans for it? Or was it something, because, you know, it sort of came to you and you, I'd never done this before.
Well, it came to me in the most hilarious of ways. So, after I left The Daily Show, one of the reasons I left was because I really wanted to make more shows like that in places that might be a little bit more open to getting that to that point of a call to action, right? So I left, and then 9/11 happened. And media was like, there is no taking on the government, there is no nothing, like, don't even try. You know, people were apologizing for their humor, and I wrote a scathing op-ed that, like, took on many of my brethren in comedy and in late night who, I don't know if you remember after 9/11, but a lot of people were like giving these testimonials, apologizing for their humor and apologizing for all this shit and saying, I was sitting in the back of the room, you know, shooting spitballs. And it's like, well, why the fuck were you doing that? So I wrote an article that said, if you're ashamed of your comedy on September 13th, you should have been ashamed of your comedy on September 10th. Because if you weren't trying to make a difference and you knew you were taking money and you were like shaming women and being sexist and being racist and being homophobic and you did that anyway because it was just fun and that was the joke, that's on you. That's not on patriotism. That's not America. And by the way, if our country gets attacked and bullshit happens and our government's being bullshit, it's part of your job to call that out, not to cower. So it was just nuts. And so I had moved to LA to try to do sort of a Today Show satire that was sort of a cross between Colbert and the Today Show. And we did a couple of episodes of that. And then they were like, this is way too edgy. I was like, all right. And so I was just came back from doing the worst gig I ever did. I had to pay my bills. So I was doing this gig where I was like literally produced an MTV spring break show. Where it was like, I think I literally got a passport and gave them my soul as collateral to be in this. And I got back and I was panicking. I was literally like, I don't know what to do. And I get a call from this man who says, hey, my name's John Sinton and I'm calling because I want to launch a new radio network. And Al Franken gave me your number because he wanted to get a Liz Winstead type to run it. It's like, is there a Liz Winstead type? And it sounds like that type is sort of awful because you don't want the actual Liz Winstead. You're looking for someone like me. So I was like, well, what about me? Because I'd really like to do like a political talk show in the wake of this crazy thing. And he was like, oh, would you want, because I think they just thought I didn't want to leave TV. And I was like, I will leave anything. I will leave LA. Just get me back to New York. Please get me doing something that I can be proud of and then I can try to make a difference. So that's how I ended up there. Yeah. And then I left and with Jerry Springer. So everybody's really awesome.
You know, speaking of call to action, I'm going to ask another question and then start to take audience questions from you guys. So again, you can use that app to submit questions. I'm going to be checking your questions on my phone. And if you want to write a question, just raise your hand. And Margaret, if you're around, we'll come around with a note card to write down. But I want to get to something that you're doing now,
yes.
Which is, I love the name, Lady Parts Justice League.
Yes. That's what I'm doing now.
Because it totally fits in with what we're on stage about. And I would like to just have you sort of talk about what it is, how you got into it, and what you're looking for it to do.
Sure. So I won't call for the video yet because the video will be incongruous until for just a second.
Okay.
So how many of you came to this panel because maybe you wanted to hear a little bit about politics and humor and The Daily Show and all that? Okay. Well, there wouldn't be a politics or a humor or a Daily Show if there wasn't legal access to abortion for me. And so in the course of me, like, fighting the fight, as you all know, in this crazy world we live in, the biggest advice I give to everyone is, what is the thing that gets you up every day and gives you passion? Fight for that thing. Become an expert at it. Rally people around it. Your joy and your passion around that issue is going to really be intoxicating for other people. So for me, I was 16. I got pregnant the first time I ever had sex. I know. I was Catholic, and I was literally, you know, you make deals with yourself. You know, you're like, well, if I use birth control and have sex, that's two sins. So if I don't use birth control, it's one. I am in. So, shit happens, right? I was with a horribly abusive Minnesota hockey player who had all the compassion of somebody with a mullet. And I also knew as a kid that having kids wasn't my thing, right? I just didn't want that. I didn't see that for myself because my mom even pointed out to me, like, when you play fantasy world, you never play like house, or you don't ever play with the stove I gave you, or the ironing board I gave you. Or I was like, those are all the things you weep over about your life. No, they are not fun for me. That's like a nightmare. You might as well just give me the, you know, drunken husband that blows up and the little miniature couch that goes with it. Is that a toy? So I knew, I just knew that that wasn't for me. And so when I found out I was pregnant, I was freaked out. I was by myself. It's high school. You can't tell anybody because it's like, that's the worst, right? That's like the best piece of gossip you can lay on anybody. And so he was not supportive. I actually remember to pay for my abortion, I went into his dad's pants pocket and took the money out of his wallet. Yeah, because where am I going to get that kind of money, right? And so I didn't know where to go even because nobody, Catholics don't talk about abortion except for renting buses to have you go protest. It's crazy. So I found myself at this crisis pregnancy center, which are these fake clinics that are unregulated and they spew bullshit at people and somebody greets you at a door wearing a lab coat and you're like, oh, do you work at Lancome also? Because you got a lab coat that looks just like that. And then she shows you those mangled fetuses and then a picture of a kid on a bike and you're 16 going, is that bike inside of me? I don't even know what the hell is going on right now, but I know that I'm freaking out. And they give you a litany of bullshit. If you have an abortion, that's not even a thing. And this was 1978. And get this, and this is the thing that I think is so crucial. So the woman said to me, abortion's against our law. Not against the law. Against our law. But when you're scared and you're 16, you think you're breaking the law. So it's another level of shame, right? So I was like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. And I just knew I needed to leave because she was scaring me and I just needed to get out of there. And when I walked out the door, that woman said to me, just remember your options are mommy or murder. Yeah. And so I left there, I got on a bus. I got my abortion. I had my abortion. My abortion experience was like, I was lucky. I was 16. I didn't have to have my parents called. Somebody gave me enough agency to know that if I'm a sexual being, I can make that choice. You know, my experience is different. It was like, when you talk to people who have abortions, there's a lot of emotions around like when you have the abortion and then cut to a year later or 2 years later. And that person's life is changed forever. And so in my activism, I believe that doctors who perform abortions, I believe they're heroes. I believe they have dedicated their lives to putting people on a path. You have a hero here in Boulder and Dr. Hearn, who every day makes the lives of people better internationally and around the world. And I'm really proud to be of a community that can do that. So I wanted to take all of my things that I care about, making sure that people who need abortions can get them, using humor to raise awareness around the issue. And so I formed this Lady Parts Justice League based on, I wanted to do an organization where comics and musicians got together and we would do comedy shows. And at the end of the show, we have a talk back with people like this, with a provider. And the provider can tell the community what they need, what would make their life better, what would make their clinic better, how they can fight for legislation. Growing communities in states that are really hard. So June 2nd, my organization is leaving from Atlanta to do a 16-city tour for 8 weeks, starting in Atlanta, going to Jackson, Little Rock, Montgomery, Alabama, places that are hit hardest, so that we can grow those communities, so people can learn about independent clinics, they can learn how they can be involved. Because if somebody can give you tools as to how you can be involved, it's really incredibly helpful, and there's really small ways. If you send postcards of love to clinics, they really like that. They're happy and thrilled to know that you appreciate that they're in the community. You know, when there's horrible protesters out there, if you talk to your clinic and find out what their policies are, if you're somebody who can be a voice to counter that, to say, actually, my vote matters on this. Show another side. Bring them cupcakes. Fix their fence if they need it, their roof. Like, what can you do? And so I wanted to have an organization that did that. So we make videos. We try to break down the myths and the stigma around abortion. And so I want to show this video really quick. It's really fun. It's there's a lot of people who are really stupid, who do not even understand how reproduction works, and they somehow get elected, and they say things that are ridiculous. So sometimes they get on the Supreme Court, like Neil Gorsuch. So Neil Gorsuch ruled in the lower court ruling of the Hobby Lobby case, which was the case that said that not only corporations are people that happen, now corporations are people that have religious beliefs, and one of the religious beliefs of Hobby Lobby is that they did not want to provide birth control, that they just made up a thing that's not true in science, that certain birth controls cause abortion, like Plan B or IUDs. And it's like, turns out you can't have an abortion if you're not pregnant. Please learn things. So, when the Neil Gorsuch hearings happened, we were working on this video and we released it to teach Neil Gorsuch, A, what Plan B is, and B, how pregnancy works. So I introduced this video.
Audio.
Do we not have audio?
Audio?
It's muted.
No. We'll back it up if we need to.
Yeah, we're going to have to.
Because it's great from the start.
It's also important to learn facts, which are included.
Real facts, you mean?
There's no fake facts. There's bullshit and there's facts.
Thank you.
There's no alternative facts. No.
Yeah, just to be clear. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, no, I'm not a fan of anybody saying alternative truth. That's weird.
That's an oxymoron.
Right.
Yeah. While we wait,
yes,
if you would, just tell the story of how the group got its name,
oh,
Lady Parts.
Yes,
Justice
so,
League.
Okay, yeah, so the group got its name. So I had started, what happened was I wrote a book and I went back to Minnesota to finish my book. And I did not understand the profundity of the lack of support for local clinics. Until when I finished my book, I had to get back to Brooklyn, so I decided I would do some fundraisers because I had to drive back to Brooklyn with my dogs in a van. So you can imagine clinics are really excited when you call up and say, hey, I want to come and visit you with my dogs in a van. And they're like, yeah, no. But I did these fundraisers along the way home, and I would go visit each clinic. And every clinic I went to, either the receptionist or the nurse or the doctor would say, you know, thank you for coming. It's rare that people come. And it breaks my heart. It just breaks my heart because we have stopped paying attention to the people who are making America great. And the people who make America great are people who give people their autonomy to live their dreams. And let's not forget that. And it's like super important for me. So I just... You know, once I learned that, I knew that I could do something. And so I wanted to form this group, but I didn't have a name. And one of the clinics that I went to was in Michigan. And I was in Michigan, and I met this really wonderful state legislator who, it's very rare that a politician will actively promote expanding access to abortion care. They will often say they're pro-choice and they'll vote against things. But this woman named Lisa Brown was on the floor, and she was fighting against a transvaginal ultrasound bill, which is basically, ultrasounds when you need them are incredible. Ultrasounds when you don't need them and they're state sanctioned are basically a version of rape, in my opinion. So she was fighting against this. You had to have a state sanctioned ultrasound before you could terminate your pregnancy. She was thrown off the floor of the Michigan State House for using the word vagina. And when she asked the Speaker of this House what she should say, he said something more acceptable like lady parts. So, while I know the name, and I've had people really like it, I've had trans people say it feels not inclusive, I've had trans people say, oh, I get it now that you tell me that. So we're a super inclusive organization. When it comes to reproductive health, we talk about the reproductive health of all genders, we care. But to me, it's an homage to somebody doing some really hard work. And so the name to me was, if somebody is going to take that extra mile, I want to pay a tribute to them in a way that, because it's just so rare. So that's how the name came to be. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry I cried. That's too bad.
It's okay. As Marv Albert used to say, let's go to the videotape.
Yes, let's see what we can have here.
Dwayne, the real Johnson made me laugh.
Very funny.
Sorry, ma'am. I have to get another cashier to sell you Plan B.
Why?
Because Plan B causes abortion. And I don't have to sell it to you because abortion goes against my religious beliefs.
Wait, it's not an abortion, and double wait, a cashier can deny me birth control?
You are correct, ma'am. That is actually the law, and I don't like it. Listen up, Mr. Cashier.
I'm just a pill, a kind of birth control pill. No matter what they say on Capitol Hill, well, it's a wrong, wrong story they keep telling. You is block pregnancy. I wish they missed what scientists say. So at the end of the day, you can chill, drop some facts, tell the world I'm a pill.
Gosh, pill? Preventing an unwanted pregnancy seems so helpful. How'd you get so many enemies?
Well, a lot of folks like this fella got together and decided that I cause abortions, but I don't.
I stop ovulation from happening, preventing fertilization and pregnancy.
Wait. A fertilized egg isn't a pregnancy?
Nope. After an egg is fertilized, it takes 72 whole hours for the egg to make its way to the uterus and implant itself. That is a pregnancy. My job is to stop the egg from ever traveling to Fallopian Town.
Preventing that pregnancy.
So life doesn't begin at conception?
When life begins is an opinion. When pregnancy begins is a scientific fact. Are you getting it yet?
Kinda.
Well, think of it like a football game. The quarterback drops back and tosses to the receiver at the 20-yard line. The fertilization happens the second the receiver catches the ball. Now, we all know the rules. The fertilized egg still needs to make it into the end zone before it's a touchdown.
But if there is no ball to catch,
there can never be a touchdown.
Now you're getting it. Doctors say pregnancy doesn't happen until the touchdown. So my job is to block that touchdown from happening. And I do.
Wow, Plan B. You're like the Deion Sanders of preventing pregnancy.
Actually, Deion Sanders wishes he was the Plan B of football. I hope that cleared things up. But just in case it didn't,
I'm just a pill, a helpful birth control pill. No matter what they say on Capitol Hill. So now you know my truth. I'm all about prevention. If your condom breaks, I'm here for intervention. Join me, take a stand today. I really hope and I pray that you will drop some facts, tell the world I'm a pill.
Wow, Bill. Science is fun. Turns out you prevent more abortions than anyone I know. I'd be happy to sell you to customers.
That's right. Prevention's my jam. Bye now.
Wait, Pill. Will I ever see you again?
Well, let me put it to you this way, kid. I'm always here if you need me. And I'm really safe, so you don't even need a prescription.
Even if you're a teenager?
Yep, even if you're a teenager. Oh, and just one more thing. I know I'm awesome, but please, always use a condom.
Join me, take a stand today. I really hope and I pray that you will drop some facts. Tell the world I'm a pill.
PJL shuts down the fake facts around birth control and abortion every damn day. Join us and help spread the truth.
So, how many of you sort of didn't know that? Right? I know, it's okay, but like, it's good to know. But what's really cool about this video, so we made this video to be snarky and edgy, but four different school systems around the country are now using, we just released this like literally 2 weeks ago, and they're using it to teach their teen pregnancy stuff. So it's pretty, like, it's good. Yeah. So, pretty cool.
It's like Schoolhouse Rock for adults.
Well, it was a ripoff of Schoolhouse Rock, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
It looks it.
Put a little Schoolhouse Rock in your sex life, why not?
Thank you for not using Fraggle Rock, by the way. A question from the audience. Come on. How can we elect someone who does not have a sense of humor? How can that happen?
That's a really good question. I think that, I don't know. I mean, I actually don't know how you elect someone who doesn't have a... Donald Trump never laughs. Have you noticed that?
He does not smile.
He never smiles. He has no joy. And I think that's really weird because, like, making someone laugh is the gateway to everything else, right? Liking them, wanting to get to know more about them, caring about them. And so the fact that this monster, I don't know, you know, I don't know how you elect Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know how that happens, that somebody can just make up shit about themselves and people go, life is so bad and I hate Hillary so much, so I'm going to go with that. I don't know how that happens.
A student question. What's your best strategy to convince men to stop messing with women's reproductive rights?
Talk about them more. Require men and everyone to look at, if you say you're a human rights, if you care about human rights, and if you say that you care about equality, if you're not taking reproductive rights and abortion access and centering that in your life, your decision when and if you want to have a family is one of the first things you make that will set you on a path forever. And I would demand it as a requirement for your, like, humanity.
I just want to read a comment from someone. They say, I really hope that's not how a condom breaks.
I usually have a mallet next to my bed. Yeah.
Very active. Another question from a student. I've experienced a lot of sexist or masculine-dominated humor in college or social humor. How do we change this social level of joking and humor for the better?
You know, those kind of things are really interesting because changing humor means, I don't know what that really means, but what I do know is, I mean, we still live in a society where people write think pieces about whether asking questions are women funny. So what I say is, the humor that you like and enjoy, amplify that. And if you hear something that's sexist and awful, ridicule it. Like, sometimes call-in culture I'm not into. Sometimes I'm like into full-blown ridicule that shit. Because if it's uncool and it's not making society better and you don't like it, you know, that First Amendment thing, it goes both ways. Somebody says something shitty, step up. You know, why are you quiet? You know, it was very frustrating to me after the election when I heard these constant narratives of people saying, like, oh, how am I going to go home and talk to my family? Like, I don't know what to do. I had people who voted for Trump in my life. And it's like, you want to know what? If you're going to go home when a fascist has been elected and you think making the peace is not having a conversation, and then that's swallowed, you're not at peace, and that person walks away. And if you have people of color or trans people or anybody in your life that isn't going to be completely harmed by this administration, it is your obligation as a person who invited them into your life to represent them to people who voted for Trump. Like, I don't get it. It's a false peace. Not having a conversation about things that are awful is not peace. It's usually you acquiescing. And I just want to say one other thing to it because it drove me insane. It was always in, like, liberal press and, like, how will we deal with our family? It was all of us, or people who feel who are progressive or liberal, asking that question. I didn't read one thing in conservative press, and I read all the press, of conservatives saying, hey, we won. Maybe we should be nice and not gloat to our liberal people we love. I never saw one article that was that. Not one.
In kind of a related question, when you were growing up, you've said that pretty much Joan Rivers was the only female that you saw.
Yeah,
you
know. Joan Rivers, you know, it was Joan Rivers, there was Phyllis Diller, there was...
Moms Mabley,
yeah, sure. You know, there was women who did not have my life experience as, like, stand-ups. And so when somebody said, you know, you should try stand-up, like, my first reaction was it didn't occur to me that I could, because I didn't see myself, and that's why I think it's, like, so important always to, you know, having women and having everybody, women and people of color, you know, I mean, I think that I love this conference, but I really think that this conference could be off the charts great if we had all of these different people being able to tell their stories to us, right? Because our futures are depending on it, and our world is changing so much in who we are, and you want to be able to hear from people so that we can all be great allies. You know, it's just a gift that we have, and we should be sharing it, this cool place and these amazing people. And you know, I really want to learn about, like, the feminism of many people who don't look like me, and learn about the journeys of many people who don't look like me, and I just think it's super important. Like, you got a cool thing going here. Let's, like, make it really off the charts.
Kind of coming off of some of the social change that we've been talking about, a question is, how do you think climate change should be talked about to get people to take it seriously? I'm assuming that you
mean using
it.
Humor?
Yeah.
Well,
you know, again,
first of all, who let clean coal be a thing? Like, that's a thing that people, like, went, oh, we're just going to say clean coal. Like, another, that's a real fucking thing.
Another oxymoron.
Right. So, I mean, that's just, like, and I also, you know, but you look at things, and I just feel like practicality sometimes can be the best part of humor. You know, you talk about fracking, and it's like, you know, when you turn your faucet on and fire pours out, maybe we're not quite ready to frack. Not to mention, like, you read articles of, like, cows that are, like, wandering off and drinking, like, water that's got, like, fracking dispersants in it. And it's like, you know, cows, when they fart, like, create methane. So if fracking water lights on fire, and you have a cow farting, you're going to wind up with, like, self-barbecuing cow. Which is probably, Monsanto is, like, in the room, like, writing this down, running out, like, oh my God, that's amazing. But, like, you know, sometimes just pointing out the absurdity of, like, because so often things aren't thought through and then we find ourselves in a shit show. So pointing out the lack of process is something I like to do in humor, because it's like, if you leave out A to F and go, we're going A to G, it's like, but A, C and D and E, and that's good. You know, if you can point that out, I think you can get people to think. Because you don't want to make people feel dumb. You want to make people feel like they're part of the getting screwed part of all of this, right? So I often like to say, do you know this thing happened? And people are like, no, what? And like, oh my God, okay, you're probably busy. So here's what happened. And that's a much better approach than just like harping on people for not paying it up and you didn't watch this and blah, blah, blah. You know, I just want people to care. And hopefully, you know, through enthusiasm, you can get people to...
So, you know, something that you and I kind of briefly touched on is, you know, like 50 years ago, Mort Saul, Lenny Bruce were talking about edgy humor, but it seems to me that humor now has taken on almost a call to action, you know, in a mass sense, like with John on The Daily Show.
Yeah, some people are doing that.
You know, well, when you say some people, what do you mean by some people?
Not everyone.
Yeah.
You know, I think some people are a bummer, but some people are great. You
but
know,
is there a, quote unquote, right way and wrong way to do that? If you wanted to do humor that has a call to action and not just, you know, you're going to laugh and then walk out later and kind of forget about it.
You know, I'm never going to tell anybody to do their humor away, like say that there's a wrong way. What I will say is sometimes just observing what someone looks like, and whether that's in a sexist way or just in a lazy political way, it tells me more about you than it does about that person. It just tells me that you're lazy and sort of cruel. And so, and I don't learn any more about the issue or the person, right? And so, you know, saying Donald Trump is orange is, tells me that he's orange. You know, saying that Donald Trump, his entire administration feels like a bunch of Macy's balloons that got loose and they just start going into buildings, you know, gives you an emotional feeling about what that's like. Chaos, bloated airbags, you know, just like a lot of stuff, right?
Tell us how you really feel.
I know. So, you know, I like to give people a lot of some stuff about, you know, about my targets. It's not really interesting to me that, you know, someone is, you know, I don't know. I just feel like it's crazy that, like, you look at this cabinet and I just, every single person who holds a cabinet position is the last person that any sane person would call to run those cabinets. Like, it's a joke! So you're just like, oh my God, yeah.
I have an opinion he never wanted this job, so he didn't really prepare for it. He just wanted the attention.
He doesn't want any job. I think he thought Barack Obama was popular because he was president. Oh, presidents are popular. It's like, no, that's not really true. That's not
the way you think.
No.
Question from a student. What's the greatest career advice that you've received, whether as a comedian or as an activist? I'll add in.
You know, I don't even know if it's career advice, but somebody said to me once, you matter, act like it. Mm. So, I think that we matter, we should act like it. And that's hard. It's like takes a lot of work, but do it.
You kind of remind me of the quote that your dad, that Paul mentioned last night.
My poor dad.
If you would say that, if you would tell the audience that quote.
Oh, yeah. So, my dad was like, from Philadelphia, Mississippi, met my mom in World War II, and they moved to Minnesota. And he was like furious he was in Minnesota. He called it the People's Republic of Minnesota. And like, he would literally go down to the local radio station and bitch about Hubert Humphrey every single day of my life. I think he voted for Harold Stassen. For those of you who know what I'm talking about, please give me a laugh. Please let me see where am I at? Where my Stassen's at? Okay, good. So, but my dad raised five really strong, fierce kids who didn't agree with him on anything. And he would always pick fights with us because I think he knew we were smart and he saw himself in us in the way we fought. And so he would say to us constantly whenever there'd be a fight, he goes, damn it, I raised you kids to have an opinion and I forgot to tell you it was supposed to be mine.
Typical parent.
Yes.
Yeah. Two student questions, and they're similar enough. I'll read one of them. And kind of let me get to the end, because it starts in one way, and you're going to think one way, and it changes when we move on. Racial humor tends to be a funnier type of humor. My thinking is because it uses preconceived notions. Racism, however, is not okay. How do you create effective humor that has a positive effect on society?
Well, I mean, racial humor and racist humor, that's a very fine line that why are you even, what is the point of the humor when you're talking about someone's race? Is it about the preconceived notion? Isn't that racism? Right? So I don't know if I buy into all of that. I don't make jokes about someone's race. I make jokes about someone's character. So that's what I look at when I talk about someone. And I often think it's a racist society that will not let you tell a joke about someone's character because, like I was saying yesterday, when Obama got elected, I had all these reporters call me up and they're like, how are you going to tell jokes about Obama? What are you going to do? And I was like, I'm going to talk about the fact that he came up through a really corrupt system. And when he screws up, I'm going to talk about it. Like, there's a lot of things about Obama you can take on, you know, the banks, Tim Geithner, drones, you know, there's a lot of stuff. So the fact that you are basically saying to me, he's black, what are you going to do? It's like, yeah, you know, your subtext is like jarring. But what was the second part of that question? Maybe I can speak to that. Something about how do I do something for good or something?
Well, how do you create effective humor that has a positive effect on society?
I think you create what you believe in. You know, it's like you can't decide what kind of effect your humor is going to have. You can only do the humor that you believe will elevate a conversation, elevate hypocrisy, you know, that you can believe and stand by and defend, and, you know, give people some information about people they don't know. You know, there's so much shit that's going on that people don't know that the best way to elevate it is almost, if you're a good storyteller and you can, like, I love to tell the story. There's a politician, state rep in Idaho, who actually asked the question on the floor of the state house, why can't a woman just swallow a camera to get her gynecological exam? And you're like, and a woman who was actually a colleague of his had to stand on the floor and more eloquently than I said, if that was the case, then people would be pregnant from blowjobs. So I just elevated some serious discourse right there, people. That was like a blowjob joke and an informational joke, and nobody should vote for that guy. See what I did there? Yeah. You're welcome.
It kind of leads me to a point, you know, using a term that we've heard a lot of in the past year and a half. You know, can comedy normalize issues that really shouldn't be normalized?
What does that mean?
Well,
like, what's an issue that shouldn't be normalized? Like Donald
racism.
Trump? Well, you know, here's where I think comedy can normalize horrible things, is when people say this, and this is a phrase that drives me insane. I'm an equal opportunity offender. It's like, people don't have equal opportunity, so no, you're not. You know, so that's like a big way of people saying they want to take on stereotypes for humor that, like, can really make lives really horrible for people. So I feel like, until we become a society that understands there's no such thing as an equal opportunity offender because people come from various different places. I mean, the fact of the matter is, humor now that maybe would be considered satire is now proposed as policy. You know what I mean? Like the exaggerative nature of what we used to do. And so if you're not smart enough to know when you're going to take on a topic, I had a joke in my act where they're like, I don't even know how we're going to go to war when half of our tanks are already in Syria and half of them are in Ferguson. You know, that's just real. And sometimes things are just real to set into something else. You know, that's a joke about a lot of stuff. So it's like, I think that you have to be cognizant that there is white supremacy in our country. White people run it, so that's the way it is. And so, equally punching down on people who don't have any power doesn't work. It just doesn't work for me. Thanks.
You in touch with Jon Stewart at all?
You know, he's got some weird beard now, and he's doing some really cool thing on HBO. He's awesome. He, like, left, and now he's got, like, this animal sanctuary, and he's, like, just living life. He is exhausted. That show is an exhausting show to do for a really long time, and I think that he is, like, doing it. I think he's, like, keeping his life really simple. I haven't talked to him in a while.
Yeah. Do you see him kind of coming back into something similar?
I don't know.
I think there's such a call for people that want him back.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I know he's doing something for HBO, and I don't know what it is. It's been very secretive. I mean, it's like been like a thing that he's like keeping under wraps. And so my guess is that knowing him, he has a fire in his belly that I was having lunch today with some other panelists who I've met some really great people here. I feel really excited about that. But we were talking about when you hear somebody who is taking on the role of a social critic or a comedian, the one thing that makes me drawn to them is when you can tell what keeps them up at night and then what wakes them up in the morning, right? And so I know that what keeps John up at night and what wakes him up in the morning are things that are injustice. So I think that he will do something. I can't imagine he's just going to be all of a sudden be like, I do. I'm just going to have a show on Animal Planet. Like, I can't imagine that's going to be a thing.
Because he can.
Home and garden show. He's just weird. He's going to be setting tables. He loves the china.
I knew that.
Wedgwood. Loves Wedgwood. Collects it.
I don't know
what I'm saying at this point.
You need a nap.
I know. Yeah. No, I'm good. I'm good. I just want to drink some more in a minute.
I knew that you were interested in politics when I saw the name of your book.
Yeah.
Okay, if you want to tell people what that is and plug it.
I have a book. It's called Liz Free or Die. I think they ran out of copies here, but you can order it on the internet for like $2.
There were some paperbacks out in the lobby.
I read my own book, so it's like this, but me like telling you about my fucked up life. So it's kind of fun to hear it. If my voice doesn't grate on you, I would suggest maybe a download of a book, hearing it.
I read that Forbes wrote this about Molly Ivins. Ivins' pen pierces both the brain and the funny bone. And I thought, when I read that you're a perfect person to sit on the stage for the Molly Ivins plenary, because I feel the same way about you.
That's incredibly kind. I feel like Molly Ivins was one of the people who, every moment of her life, she gave zero fucks, and she was brilliant. And she cared so deeply about democracy. And she was so funny. And she was so great. And so it's a little intimidating to sit on a plenary knowing that Molly Ivins was the person that many people got to enjoy before me. And I'm humbled, and that's a very nice thing to say, but like, if there wasn't a Molly, there probably wouldn't have been a Liz. So thank you, Molly.
Thank you, Molly. Did you ever get a chance to meet Molly?
Never.
Yeah.
I interviewed her once on Air America, but I never got to meet her in person. But no. I have become really good friends with Ellen Sweets, the lovely Ellen Sweets. And so I've been lucky enough to read Ellen's relationship with Molly and Ellen's fabulous book. That's a great comfort for me, actually.
So, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Please help me say thank you to the Molly Ivins Memorial Plenary recipient.
Thank you. Thank you.